when teachers start to teaching mindfulness to children, it's, I think, important to know something about your own motivation. Why are we wanting this? Why do we wish to teach children mindfulness? Is that something we want, or is it something they need? Or, well, what kind of answers could be about it? So I would like to ask you to get some paper and a pen for yourself. It's a kind of writing exercise. So this is about our own motivation, why we want to teach children mindfulness. So the first question is, and you can, I would like to ask you to don't think too much about the answers you want to write down for yourself. It's just for yourself. But just let the question resonate with your own inner wisdom. And then just follow, in a way, the inner answer that's coming up. So try to don't think intellectually about this question, but just let the question resonate with something inside you. And the first question is, why is mindfulness important for kids? Why is mindfulness important for kids? And take all the time you need for a kind of answer. And you can just stay with this calmness yourself. And let come up by itself an answer on the following question. Is mindfulness important for every child? Is mindfulness important for every child? And why or why not? And then there's a third question. When you would be the mindfulness teacher or the mindful parent, what do you want your kid or the kids in your class to learn from you when mindfulness is practiced at home or in the school? What do you want the kids to learn from you? What do you want to teach them? And then maybe the last question. What inner attitude do you need to support the children at home or in your classroom? What inner attitude do you need to support the children? Okay. So, Henk, I think you need the microphone again, because it can be nice to hear from each other some answers about, for example, the first question, why is mindfulness important for kids? Why should we do that? Who wants to share something about this question? Why should we teach children mindfulness?
I think it's important to help them stay calm, to help them get in touch with what's now, to allow them to have more authentic relationships with people.
Yeah.
And I believe it would reduce the anxiety, which is ever increasing in their world.
to reduce anxiety. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
Well, I think that kids are now living like in an environment that is, they're just overstimulated, in so many aspects of their life that there's just really not much time for them to sit and be comfortable with just
doing
sitting,
nothing.
And that's it, you
yes.
know? And parents, you know, they want their kids to be involved in so many things, and just from activity to activity, and then to bed, and then to school, and they just really don't have time to just sit.
And do nothing.
Do nothing.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Thank you very much. That's a very important point, I think, that children in these times, and we know that all, that they get such a huge amount of stimuli, and there's no moment that they have to do or that they don't need to do anything and get bored. It's so interesting when children say in the class, well, this is boring, this sitting still like a frog, it's boring. And then when we start asking them, where do you feel in your body that boring feeling? And what is being bored? And then they start to be really interested again. They never ask themselves what, it's just a word, well, this is boring. But when they are exploring the experience of being bored, they start to be very interested in that word. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, I would say also it helps them listen to music if they're mindful.
Yeah.
I teach music, and I noticed that the attention span for listening to certainly longer pieces of music has gone really down.
Mm, yes, yes. Oh, that's lovely to teach music, I think. Yeah, and mindfulness can help them to be able to just listen to all those different tones and rhythms and, yeah, without thinking what kind of piece or what kind of performer is he or her that is making this music. Just listen to
right.
the music.
Or without having to do something else at the same time.
Yes, yeah, yeah, yeah. Just listening, yeah.
So I took a little different tact in that I said, why is mindfulness important for kids? I said, I'm not even sure it is. And the reason I asked that is, I said, if mindfulness can help them be more aware of their feelings and be more aware of their mind, how their mind works, and their connection to their bodies, then perhaps. But I said, in some ways, children will learn mindfulness by observing adults being mindful. If adults are calm, thoughtful, kind, exhibiting right speech and right action, then children will learn this.
Yes.
So I just sort of, I had a little resistance to adults teaching kids to be mindful when they themselves may not have fully embraced that. And yet I know that so much of the mindfulness teaching has gotten to the point of, if we're going to teach mindfulness, we have to be living the mindfulness ourselves.
Yeah. That's a very important point because children copy their parents, they copy their teachers. And when you have a mindful teacher in the class, there is immediately a difference in atmosphere and,
Could I just add one more? I've
heard some people that teach in the Waldorf system and they actually resist this quite a bit because they actually don't think it's developmentally appropriate for kids to be turning so much intention inward.
Mm-hmm.
That it's actually, childhood is very much an external process. And so I kind of have a little bit of agreement with that. I think that, again, I think the little dropping in and then enough adults modeling it is really of the highest value as opposed to think we're going to put it into them in some way. Is that,
yes.
I don't know if you've, because I'd imagine you've run into some people in the Waldorf systems at all. I don't know if you have, so I just, maybe you can ask that question later, answer that question.
Yeah, that's the Rudolf Steiner, yeah. We call it in Holland the Rudolf Steiner method.
Yeah.
And in fact, there are not so many Rudolf Steiner schools in Holland that give the mindfulness lessons. Because they have Rudolf Steiner. So that's another method. But you're right. Of course, it's very mindfulness always begins with yourself. as an adult. It was my first introduction here. Mindfulness with kids start with the adult, with you, as we are sitting here. And when your child is getting a mindfulness course in school, and at home he learns to yell to each other and to use all kind of words, then it becomes a trouble instead of something else. But there are also children that live in a very violent environment at home, and they get mindfulness in schools, in their classroom, and that brings them so much that they have a kind of very valuable, I don't know exactly the word, but maybe you feel what I mean, that they have something in their heart and in their mind that they can use as a tool, as a life skill. And they don't have the parents that gives them the love they need. They don't sometimes have a teacher that is very being there for them, but they have something learned from themselves, and that helps a lot. Yeah.
So one of the things I thought of in terms of myself with mindfulness is it's helped me, and I'm only guessing it would help children become more aware of the spaces. There's a lot of space in life between action to action, or words that we say to the next thing we say. And I think for me, mindfulness has helped me really appreciate and bring much more awareness to all those spaces. Mm-hmm. I remember hearing recently about a famous musician, and he plays this beautiful piece, and he talks about how it's the pauses that make the piece, you know, and it's the pauses in space and life that fill up so much of our life, and all those thoughts that go on in our mind that really are creating our reality and our life all the time. Mm. And what do we do with those thoughts when we're sitting here listening to people sharing or feeling our body against the chair? So to me, that's what mindfulness has helped me with, and I'm only guessing that that's what it helps children with too.
Yes, to be more aware of spaces, to be more aware of what's going on between people and between their thoughts and their emotions and their reaction on that, their response on that. Yeah, it's about relationship. Yes.
Yeah, all those pauses.
Yes, all those pauses. Yeah, you're right. Very important. Thank you.
So you already said this, but didn't write it down, that mindfulness can help children with trauma.
Yes.
And the brain development.
Yeah. The brain development is also a very, important part. We are just beginning to explore that. Brain development. Trauma healing sometimes. Yes.
I'm not sure of the research, is it the prefrontal cortex mostly, or is it amygdala as well? Emotional control?
Yes, it's about both.
Okay.
Yeah, and it's about stress reduction. And the amygdala is, we have two of them, is responding on stress very much. And when children doing mindfulness exercises, the amygdala reacts on that in a positive way. So it isn't firing all the signals to support children in reacting immediately, or hit someone immediately, or get a knife or a gun or that kind of things. And it reduces their reactions on stress, and it will help them to be well, fully aware of that they have a choice in reacting. And like we have our reactions on stress, we cannot avoid to have those first body reactions, but we have the choice to acting them out. And that's, for children, very important. Hmm. For the later adults, yeah. That's true.
I think that it's important for every... I think that mindfulness can help every area of life, because we talked about overstimulized, and I think that if the child, doesn't matter what they do, music or art or a sport or reading, they're not present while they're doing it. There's no benefit from all of it. So we put our children in music courses to develop their brains. You know, you put them in piano so they use the right and the left, and they sports so that they can become great athletes. But if they're not present, then they're not getting the benefits of any of these activities. And it's the same thing with school. I mean, I even remember myself in school, I didn't get much of anything because I was uncomfortable even just sitting position. Being short, my legs never touched the ground. I was never comfortable. I couldn't sit cross-legged because it wasn't appropriate. And so I think that being able to be aware of the present and find those different stimuli. I work with autistic children, and it's helping them to realize, because they can't realize the stimuli that's affecting them. So to help just sit and realize, my finger hurts, my toe's bothering me. I need to realize that so I can move forward and be here.
Yeah.
So I think that mindfulness helps with everything they do. Mindful eating, so it doesn't lead to obesity because you just eat to eat.
Yes. And
I think that mindfulness can, I mean, not just children, everyone.
Yes, that's true. And also, it we live in a time that everything and every kid has to be perform better. Everything has to be better than it is. And mindfulness teaches them that the way they are, they're good enough. They don't have to be a better child. They don't have to learn better or to act better or to perform better or that kind of things. When they do their best, the best they can, it's good enough. Yeah. And that's a very important for them. Thank you very much.
By the same token, what mindfulness can also do is help a child notice in a more embodied way their moments of competence.
Yes. Yeah, that's also very important. Yeah. Thank you very much.
So to your point about kids feeling like they're good enough, I think a lot of us adults, we become very practiced at thinking that we're not good enough.
Many
of us struggle with that. So I think one of the major opportunities with mindfulness is that we are approaching individuals, you know, these children, at a time when they haven't become as practiced with thinking about those, not practiced in a positive way, but practiced in a negative way around, you know, those not good enough sort of feelings. And then think back to the neuroscience of it all. It's fascinating, the connection. I think it's the insula that connects the amygdala and the prefrontal cortex.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
That's what they're calling the mindfulness muscle. And it's just very fascinating.
Yes. And when we do mindfulness with 25 children in a class, for example, 75% of the children who are practicing mindfulness for the first time in a class have such bad thoughts about themselves. 75% of the children thinks they are stupid. They are dumb. They are losers. And they are completely convinced of that. And that is not a thing that they make up. It's what they learn from the adults. Don't smile like this. Don't do like that. You have to act better. You have to don't sit like this, but sit like this. All the time they hear that kind of things from adults in their, intimate world. So the conclusion they make very easily is that it's about me. It's about me. I'm not good enough. I'm not sitting good enough, I'm not learning good enough, I'm not smart enough, I'm not sportive enough, I'm not humorous enough, I'm not enough. Yes. And mindfulness changes that. After 8 weeks, children are capable to have a much better feeling about just being themselves is good enough. And, well, that's a miracle, I think, almost. Yeah, that we need only, well, a few weeks of practicing being aware of this moment and knowing that not all our thoughts are true and that we are not our thoughts at all, that helps children, and they understand it very, very easy, that they are not their thoughts. And that helps children a lot, is our experience also, that when they can make a little bit space between what they think and who they are, that's just the space they need to know that, well, it's not true when they think they are a loser. That thought is not a definition of themselves. Yes, okay. What inner attitude? Well, and there were some answers right now in between all the answers we had. What inner attitude do we need to support our children? And you said it very right. I'm not sure about your name. What's your name?
Howard.
Howard, yeah. So Howard told us already that it's so important to live mindfulness as an adult when you have children, when you teach children, when you work or live with children. That's a very important attitude. Are there any contraindications, do you think, for children to receive mindfulness lessons? Are there contraindications? It's also very important to know something about that. Yes?
My understanding is that some profound trauma can be somewhat of a contraindication in that some of the reliving of the trauma can occur. So potentially being somewhat sort of tentative in, I know, not inviting necessarily using a different language, but allowing kids to keep their eyes open, for instance, if needed, and things like that. So more profound trauma.
Yeah, that's true. So that's also important for us as teachers or therapists that we know something about the background of children when you do it as a profession. And most of the children will benefit from it also when they have a profound trauma. But then sometimes we have to give them more space or the opportunity to have some individual talks with the teacher or the appointment that when something is going wrong inside that they can talk about it.
So would you recommend then if giving space, like thinking of a child who specifically, you know, had trauma, or even if the child just brings it up after a mindful sitting with themselves, almost a reflective period, like with an adult or with a facilitator or a guide to kind of help them guide them through figuring out their own thoughts or...
Well, yeah, sometimes when there is profound trauma, sometimes children don't tell us before they go into a mindfulness class, for example, and it comes out during the training. It doesn't happen so much, but sometimes it happens. And then sometimes it is better to stop the training and start a therapy. Mm-hmm. But children live in a system with parents, and sometimes parents don't want to know something about therapy, or they don't want to support a child in that. So this is, we don't have one answer for this. It's occurring, the situation, there are so many different situations, but I didn't experience a lot that children had to leave the mindfulness setting. Sometimes we had some children that lost one of their parents very shortly before doing a training, and they found it so valuable to be in the training, for example. And sometimes I had an experience with four children in a class that had a very violent background at home, and the teachers didn't know so much about it. But when we had the lesson about feeling feelings and how you can respond on difficult feelings, they started to talk about how they react on angriness, for example. And one girl told me that she was hurting herself. She was going with her fingernails on the asphalt, how do you call it? She was going to bleed. And then when one girl was telling this, the others, there were three others in the class with a very violent background at home, they could find the courage to tell a little bit more about their experiences. So one was bouncing with her head into the wall. So it was about hurting themselves. And that was the way they reacted on their own horrible feelings. And mindfulness helped them to hear, at least, that there was another way to cope with feelings. This was their only way they could deal with it. But the parents, they didn't want to do anything with mindfulness or help with, they didn't want to be helped by therapists. So sometimes it's very difficult. And you have to find a kind of way and stay in very close contact with the children and find out what they need. And most of the time, children, when you are in really contact with them, they know exactly what they need. And sometimes it's just real attention and the possibility to come to an adult and be really heard and really felt by that person. Sometimes, most of the time, that's enough. They don't need solutions. They don't need problem solving. They just need a person that really feels who they are and can come close to them. Yeah. Thank you. Okay. I think we can stop this part. But for us, this is an important guidance always to find out what our own motivation is to teach children mindfulness. So, there are four important stepping stones, I think, when we start teaching mindfulness. And when we are teaching very young children the start of mindfulness, we start with the stop button. And it's very difficult to find our own stop button sometimes. And then we ask children, where is your stop button? Where would it be? Would it be on your head? Would it be on your shoulder? Would it be in your belly? If you have a stop button, where would it be? And they find miraculous places on their bodies where their stop button might be. Yeah. And most of the time when we have a parent meeting, we also ask the parents where their stop button is, because it's not only for children. They can only use their own stop button, not use their parents' stop button, and parents cannot use the children's stop button. But, that's a very interesting thing, that stop button. Most of the time we have just go on buttons. And so that's the first step, how to use our own stop buttons and realize that we are able to stop. Children For children, it's difficult to stop, especially to stop with very nice things like eating very sweet things or gaming or do things they really like to do. They can stop very easy with homework. No problem. So, but stopping with gaming or television, it's very difficult for them. And why is that, do you think? Why is it so difficult to stop with something we really like? It's about motivation. It's just about motivation. Children are so motivated to look very long to a very interesting film. They are so motivated to go on the play yard or sport or making music if they love music. We have a son, he's a rapper from profession. And well, he had no stop button on that particular area. He could go on for hours until deep in the night with making text for his raps and finding the right tunes and that kind of thing. He couldn't stop so very easy because he was so motivated to be a good rapper. So stopping is also kind of, well, remembering. Remember that you can stop when you feel that you are getting too tired. Or so when you need your, when you have to find your stop button, you need to be in contact with your body. And that's what we are going to talk tomorrow morning, or no, tomorrow afternoon, about, to be in contact with your body. Because when you are not in contact with your body, you are not able to stop. You just stop until you're dropped down somewhere and fall asleep because you're so tired. So stopping is the first step. Stepping stone by teaching and starting mindfulness. Observing is the second stepping stone. Observing what's going on in this moment. Stopping is about stopping to be automatically going on. The third stepping stone is about relaxing. When we are not relaxed, we don't seem to have a choice of making a stop. And when we have stopped and we observe what's going on at this moment, that we can find out how we are, when we relax a little bit, then we can make the choice that is healthful or wise or whatever. Sometimes it's not wise at all, and then we find out that it's not wise at all. So the first three steps we need to make a choice, to make a conscious choice, to choose to address the situation consciously instead of reacting impulsively. And the frog can help us to make these four steps. So maybe this is a good moment of the evening to do a short frog exercise. And find out how these four steps can bring us really back in this moment and make us having the choice to refocus every moment again. So maybe you can have the intention to use those four steps and find out how important it is to don't just sit and wait for the text, but have the intention first. That is very important for children, But it's also very important for us to have the intention to really be with what we are doing now.
Exercise number one, sitting still like a frog. This exercise teaches you to sit with the attention of a frog. Stopping whatever you're doing in order to focus and observe is the beginning of every mindfulness exercise. It helps you find out what you're thinking, feeling, and doing. Stopping and observing are things you can learn from a frog. A frog jumps, stops, and sits really still while observing everything that's going on around him. When you sit like a frog, you only move when you really have to. When a frog is hungry, it moves to eat. And when it's startled, it moves a little, because it's startled. Sometimes it moves just a single eye, because a raindrop has dropped on it, or a single leg to shift its position. But it doesn't waste energy on doing things it doesn't have to do. The frog sits still, very still. And when it breathes, its frog belly rises a little and then falls again. It's alert and still. Attentive. A frog isn't easily distracted. It's aware of all the commotion around him, but it doesn't react. It sits still with mindful attention. It doesn't jump at every chance, although it's capable of enormous leaps. This way the frog doesn't get tired, doesn't do things for no reason, and doesn't get carried away by all kinds of mad ideas. It can stop jumping and be still. You too can learn to sit still like a frog. So now I'd like to ask you to sit down comfortably on a chair or on a cushion. Straighten your back so it's relaxed. And if you like, you can close your eyes or lower your eyelids as much as you're happy with. Take your time to sit up straight and relaxed. Your feet on the floor, your back straight, and your shoulders down. You can leave your hands in your lap. Now imagine you're a frog, somewhere on the edge of a large pond. Of course, you're not a real frog, but you've got something that a frog has too, the ability to sit still. And what you need to sit still is attention. Attention and calmness. The attention that stops you from jumping up and running away from what you're doing right now. And the calmness to stay seated. So take your time to focus your attention and sit still, just like a frog. Your arms and legs are still. Your bottom and your belly are still. Your back, your neck, and your head are still. Your entire body is still and calm. Mindful and calm. Still and attentive. And when you're sitting here, all still and calm, you'll notice all kinds of things. Maybe you'll notice that some small part of your body is always moving. A finger, a leg, your eyelids, or something else, and that's fine. The point of this exercise is not that you're not allowed to move, but that you notice that some part of you is still moving. So what are you noticing right now? When you notice some small movements here and there, then maybe you also notice that with each breath, some part of your body also moves. Why don't you direct your attention to the tip of your nose? there where the air goes into your nose and comes out again. What do you feel? Being aware that you're breathing is a special experience that can help you relax. Maybe you also feel the breath in your throat, in your chest, or perhaps even further down in your belly. You can put your hands on your belly and feel it move a little every time you breathe. It's kind of fun to be so tuned into your breathing. It tells you all kinds of things. It tells you whether your breathing is regular or irregular. And you may also notice the brief pauses just after you breathe in and just after you breathe out. Maybe you can tune into this brief pause after each breath. You don't have to change the way you breathe, just breathe normally, and notice how special those brief pauses are after each breath in and again after each breath out. And there's another special thing. If your breathing becomes a bit calmer and a bit deeper after a while, you'll notice that your body becomes a bit calmer too, and more relaxed perhaps. And your thoughts are calming down too. Breathing brings calm. So breathe in and breathe out again. Every time you breathe in, your belly rises a little. And every time you breathe out, it falls a little. Have a look. Direct your attention to it. To the gentle movement of the breath in your belly. It feels good to tune into your breathing. It feels good to calm down. And breathing doesn't require any special effort. Your body breathes all by itself. Observe the movement of your breath for a little while longer. It rises and it falls. It rises and it falls. And the air goes in and out again. Attention and breathing. They calm you right down at this moment. And again, at this moment. Can you feel it? You can learn a lot from a frog. You can learn not to react to everything you think, hear, or see. You're aware of everything, but you don't react unless you really have to, on purpose rather than on impulse. Sitting still with the mindful attention of a frog, practice and you'll get better at remembering things. You'll notice a lot more. I wish you lots of moments of mindful attention today and lots of fun.
And this is an exercise, the frog exercise, which children learn in the first session of the first week. We teach them in the class. And before or after this meditation, we tell them a story. For the older children, like your age, for example, it's the story about Sarah. And it's in the book Sitting Still. Maybe you read a story about Sarah when she hit her knee so much that it was bleeding a lot and she was very fearful about it. She had to go to the hospital, and well, indeed, she had to go to the hospital, and the doctor get a needle, and it has to be stitched. And I was with that girl when it happened. It's all the stories in the book are real stories. So when I met this girl, Sarah, on the camping place, and she was bleeding and she was completely pale of fear and shivering and almost I asked her to just be with her breathing. And when I asked her to do that, and in the meantime I was on her back doing like this to keep her a little bit calm. The mother was on another place on the camping. And then she asked me, can I do this also when I have to go to the hospital with the ambulance? And I said, sure, it will help you a lot when you are with your breathing. You are not thinking about all those things that can happen to you. So she really tried that and did it for the first time, and it helped her so much that afterwards she came back to the camping and she had a lot of stitches and her knee was all white with bandages and that kind of things. But she said to me, I did it. I could be with my breath during the time that the doctor went with his needle in my knee. And sometimes I get the question from teachers, isn't the story too much for the children? Because, well, it's not a funny story. But children really have found out that they have these kind of experiences themselves. When I was 7, I was on my bike, and I never forget that moment, and I ran into a caravan that was right in front of me, and it was parked, that caravan, and my chin was a little bit like the other way where my face was, and it was all over blood, and children, well, fall down and fall out of trees and have a lot of accidents. So this isn't such a bad story, I think. But for the little ones, we have other stories, and I would like to end this evening with the story the little ones get to hear before they do a breathing exercise. And it's about Freddy the Frog. One beautiful sunny day, Freddy the Frog spots his friend Hector to Hobgoblin. Hector the Hobgoblin, do I pronounce it right?
Hobgoblin.
Hector the Hobgoblin is always cheerful. Riding on his Hobgoblin bike, he sings a song into his beard. Whoop-de-doop-de-ding, I always do my ding. Whoop-de-doop-de-dee, I've come up with a great idea. Whoop-de-doop-de-hop-la-hey, I'm having a wonderful day. And then, suddenly, wham! Before he knows, he's on the ground. He has a terrible fall. His nice red coat is dirty. His beard is caked in the mud. And his hands hurt. They hurt a lot. His hands took the brunt of the fall. He's afraid to look at his hands. They hurt so much. Maybe his hands are torn to pieces and will never be whole again. Now what? Freddy the Frog is sitting by the pond when he hears a noise. What could that be? A soft and sad sobbing and sniffling in the forest behind him. Who could it be? He sets off in search and soon comes across by his friend Hector the Hobgoblin. Sorry. Hobgoblin. What's happened, Hector? He asks. Hector can barely talk through his tears. He looks ghostly pale with fright. But Freddy the Frog has already figured it out. Hector has had a terrible fall, and all he can do is cry. Why don't you place your hand on your belly, my friend, he says, and look at me. First you breathe in, and then you breathe out again. In and out again. Breathing like a frog is great help when you've had a fright and you're in a lot of pain. Go ahead, do it a couple more times. Gradually, the crying becomes less. There's just the occasional sob now. Hector notices that it helps. He even has the courage to look at his hands, which are itching so much. They're bleeding. For a split second, he panics again. Carry on breathing, Hector, Freddy tells him. And sure enough, it calms him right down. He becomes calmer and calmer. Breathing helps. Always? Yes. Always. Especially after you have fallen. And what about the blood? A Band-Aid will take care of the blood. Especially the ones with the pictures. The fun pictures. So this is the way the stories can support the meditations. And in every lesson, there is a meditation, a story, and a kind of a small movement, mindful movements.